thank you, Cliff, for those good readings and the songs that accompanied them to call our minds to the subject of the hour, for the prayers and the everything that we engage in here as we come together. Let's be thankful, and I know that we are. Again, let me say how thankful I am for you and for the great contribution you make to this work through your singing. And that's probably one of the lesser ways you contribute, and yet I think it's tremendous. I'd like to pay tribute tonight before we go into the lesson proper. We just about at this time of the year, began our fourth year with you. It doesn't seem possible that this is the beginning of the fourth year, but it is. You may think it's longer than that, but it's just four. It's been very pleasant. I couldn't think of a place on earth that I would rather be than right here. And I mean that, and if the elders only knew it, I'd be glad to pay them to let me stay. But they don't know that, I think, so don't tell them. I couldn't stay very long if I had to pay them very much, but it's good to be with you. And I want to pay tribute also to Terry Smith and his good wife, Charlotte, and the tremendous impact that they're making upon this community. What a genuine pleasure it is to work with him. I said this at the early service in his absence and her absence, and I want to say it now in their presence. Boy, we are fortunate to have them working with us. I'm just thankful to God for you, Terry, and you know that, but I wanted to say it publicly. I also paid tribute to my good wife. She was at the early service. She's my right arm. Man, I don't know what I'd do without her. She's such a godly person, and she's just a great influence for good. And I think this community is feeling the impact of her influence, and I'm thankful for her. And for the sake of those of you who are new, I told them that we had five children, and they're all here, there and yonder, no telling where, but they're all around here. I don't know how much we need to introduce ourselves. If everybody did that, I know we wouldn't ever have time to do anything else, but allow me that one privilege, if you will. I wish I could give you an insight into my brain. That'd probably scare you to death, and I'm not sure I'd want you in there. But I wish it could be done for the purpose of giving you and getting before you a clear concept of where we're going this year. For the next semester, this semester, we're going to be in a parallel endeavor, two parallel lines of thought. One, as the elders have asked that we preach a series on the church, which will actually be a lesson on the collective ministry of the body. We've got to go out of here as we go from this locale to the whole world, and that's where we'll be scattering ourselves. We've got to go out of here with a clear concept of what the church is. We can't allow ourselves to go out fuzzy and not really sure as to what the body of Jesus Christ is. And the elders have asked that I spend time on this, and it's a privilege to do so. The other ministry, the other series, will be a parallel to that and will be taken out of the second book of Corinthians. And it will deal with our individual ministry, with the preparation of ourselves, with the cleansing of ourselves and the developing of ourselves and the ridding of ourselves of whatever is inappropriate in the lives of a believer. And we're going to be doing this probably at night on the evening services. The morning services we'll dedicate to the study of the church. The evening services to the study of our own personal individual ministry. I hope you'll bring your Bibles at both of these services, and I hope you'll be patient with me. I find that I'm not very helpful in helping you follow along with your Bibles. The rustling of pages during a service to me is the most beautiful music that you can make. And yet I find that I don't encourage it like I ought to, because I get to going and I forget that, you know, that you're not an instant machine that can just flip over at a moment's notice. And if I get to going and really, I'd like for you to kind of lock into the text, and we'll be making excursions out of there, and I won't wait on you to go to every one of these verses, but lock into that text and bring your pencil and do some underlining, and we're going to be doing some in-depth study of the 2 Corinthian letter, one of the most fantastic writings in all the Bible. And I used to wonder what in the world it was ever written for. I couldn't get any sense out of it for anything. But boy, I found out what the sense is, and I'm going to be talking to you about our individual ministry from that aspect or from that viewpoint for the next several weeks. So we'll be more or less approaching it on a parallel basis, the corporate ministry of the church, the individual ministry taken from 2 Corinthians about chapters 2 through 6. And so with that brief statement of introduction, I'd like to use tonight as a springboard, similar to the way we used this morning as an introductory springboard into a study on the church. Strangely enough, both of these use parallels out of the Old Testament. That wasn't planned, it just happened. But all of a sudden I realized that both of these are taken and stand, the lesson stands on a parallel passage in the Old Testament to one in the New Testament. And so we're going to be studying it and approaching it from that viewpoint. I'm going to use as a springboard into the lesson tonight, and not as the text, the reference made or the text read just a moment ago by Cliff, chapter 4 of Ephesians, and verses 11 and 12. I want you to look there with me, if you will. Take your Bibles just for a moment, and let me read, and then I'm going to translate it according to a specific reference to the verbs and the prepositions, the coloring of this, in a way that will highlight our emphasis for the next few weeks. His gifts were that some should be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, for the equipment of the saints for the work of ministry. Now, actually, that ought to be, in order to gain its clearest, the clearest view of it, it should literally be translated for the purpose of equipping the saints in order to do the work of ministry. Now, many times it's clouded and we don't know what the work of the apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors and teachers is for. The end result of that, he says, is for the purpose of equipping the saints so that the saints can do the ministry in the church. Now, I don't know whether that's a new concept to you or not. It's certainly not new to the New Testament. But let me say it again, then we're going to, I'll just hit it and run. This passage is saying that the end result of the apostles, evangelists, pastors, and teachers, this four or five core group, that the work of these people is realized only whenever the members of the church have been equipped to do the ministry in the church. Now, are you clear on that? If you're not, we'll come back to it later and we'll be developing it more fully. But it just simply says that each one of us has a ministry. I'm not the minister here. I'm one of the ministers. I minister in a particular way of the word. But each one of us has a ministry. And it's this that Paul is talking about here in Ephesians 4, and that Christ gave gifts to all of us. And the gifts that he gave to present to the church and to prepare them for this overall ministry were the apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers, so that all of us might become equipped to do the ministry in the body. All right, so much for that, and we're going to leave that for just a moment. And may I then, by way of introduction, make some observations about this congregation and our particular needs today. I'm confident that we're being confronted by a monumental task. The one thing that's been presented to me the 3 or 4 years that I've been here is that we've got a whole lot of unharnessed mules. A whole lot of unharnessed power. The one thing that seems to be insurmountable is this task of putting everybody to work so that everybody will feel that they are a part of the body. And it seems that this task has always eluded the member or the elders, it's always eluded the leadership to where the vast majority of the congregation still feel that they are unattached, that they're not really and truly plugged in and are not really working. And that's our, I think, a task that sometimes seems insurmountable. More and more, we're multiplying. We're adding members week after week. Last year, these two aisles or rows of seats in the upstairs were full twice a Sunday morning and twice on Sunday night. it has almost already come to be that both these and these are full, both services Sunday morning and both services Sunday night. So more and more, we're continually increasing and coming to be a larger and larger body of people. And the job of putting all of us to work is one that's increasingly demanding. How are we going to go about organizing? How are we going to go about utilizing all of this manpower and womanpower in order to bring about the best good for the church? How are we going to go about eliminating the feeling that the Apostle Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, when he says, as he talks about the members of the body and makes them speak, and says, because the ear is not the eye, the ear says, I'm not a part of the body. How can we eliminate that feeling of not being a part of the body? Or because the hand or the foot is not a hand, he's saying, I'm not a part of the body. Well, he says, that doesn't make you any less a part of the body. But anyway, we want to eliminate, if possible, that feeling that we're not really a part of the body. The most recent recurring observation about the college church that really is kind of detrimental is that, well, I don't really feel like I'm involved there. I can go out to a small congregation, I can feel involved there, but I can't really get the feeling that I'm involved at the college church. And I understand that feeling. I understand why we've got it. Because the larger you are, the more you tend to a lot of unharnessed energy. Now, I believe we've turned the corner. And that may be just hopeful thinking and wishful thinking, but I believe that we have turned the corner. I believe that there are some concepts that are being focused in the minds of the elders, the deacons, a lot of the members of the church. I believe Terry's got a clear concept of it. I believe that these concepts are being focused, and I also believe that programs of work are being implemented or being brought to bear and being organized in order to implement these concepts and facilitate the carrying out of them into the membership. I think I can see that. Recently, in an article in Christianity Today, I was able to get a handle on the problem. A man very wisely, a man by the name of Mr. Christensen, Larry Christensen, wrote an article on how to delegate responsibility to the point that the entire body can become a functioning body. And he mentions two parallel passages, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament. Both of these passages deal with the people of God during a time when meeting the needs of large numbers of people was the need of the day. That was the order of the day. That which was most necessary, most urgent, was to meet the increasing needs of an ever-increasing body of people. And he just about put his finger on this particular problem. The two parallel passages that he mentions are one in the book of Exodus chapter 18 and the other in the book of Acts chapter 6. The one in Exodus 18, and I'll just tell you about it, I won't read it in detail, but when Moses and the children of Israel had come up out of the land of Egypt, they had been in the wilderness now not for many days, and on this particular occasion they'd just gotten through fighting with the Amalekites. And Moses and the children of Israel prevailed, you remember, as long as Moses held his hands up. But when his hands got tired and he let them down to rest, the Amalekites would prevail. Well, after that in and out and up and down battle, the children of Israel prevailed. And the children of Israel were more or less gathering themselves and getting themselves back together after the battle. When a messenger came to Moses and said, Moses, your father-in-law is coming. And he's got your wife with him and your children. Zipporah, your wife and your children are with your father-in-law, and they're coming to see you. And this would have been the first time after several months that Moses had seen his wife and children. And so the scripture says that when Moses' father-in-law and his wife and all came, that Moses went out and kissed his father-in-law. I don't know, but Moses was a strange man in some ways, but this is just what it says. He went out and kissed his father-in-law and began talking to him. Didn't say much to Zipporah. Why, I don't know. But he didn't say much to them. Doesn't even say that he said hello to the kids or anything. He just started talking to his father-in-law. But anyway, it just didn't record the rest of it, I guess. Or maybe he just didn't say anything to her. I don't know. But anyway, when Moses and his father-in-law got together, they began talking about all the things that God had done through Moses for the Israelites and was doing through the Israelites. It seems that Moses took the day off and began just simply visiting. They went into the tent, it says, and they just sat around talking about all the things that God had done through those people during those momentous days. And then it seems that they retired for the evening. They went to sleep. It says the next day, it doesn't say that Moses went back to work. It just says that he began again to judge the children of Israel. He went up on a seat and sat down upon a chair or a seat or some prominent place, and the people stood around and were coming to him for counsel. Now listen. On the morrow, Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from morning till evening. When Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit alone and all the people stand about for you, or stand about from morning till evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, they come to me, and I decide between a man and his neighbor, and I make them know the statutes of God and his decisions." Moses' father-in-law said to him, "What you're doing is not good. You and the people with you will wear yourselves out, for the thing is too heavy for you, and you're not able to perform it alone." Now, he saw those people standing on one foot and then on the other foot and sighing. Did you ever stand in a registration line all day long? Yeah, that'll give you an idea about what these people were going through. And Moses' father-in-law said, "Man, get you a computer. Do something other than make these kids stand around all day from morning till evening. Get you some help." Listen to this three-point program that he gave him. "Listen now to my voice. I'll give you counsel and God be with you. Number one, you shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God. And two, you shall teach them the statutes and the decisions and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do. And number three, choose able men from all the people, such as fear God, men who are trustworthy and who hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, and let them judge the people at all times." And that's the way they took care of a real pressing problem. How do you deal with 4 million people? Well, not through one man. Moses had become a bottleneck instead of a channel. Well, God hadn't meant for him to be a bottleneck. He had meant for him to be a channel. And Moses' father-in-law was a wise old man, and he said, "You listen to what I say to you. You give yourself to prayer, to the teaching of the word, and then you appoint some helpers." All right? Again, turn over to the New Testament. In the 6th chapter of Acts, you're going to find a similar situation there. It says there in verse 1 of chapter 6 of Acts, this was after the church had been established now. By the way, part of our growth happened just a moment ago. And I've forgotten your name, and I didn't bring the card with me. Tell me your name. We want you to stand up. Joe Buchanan. Joe, stand up a minute. Joe Buchanan is a new Christian. He's a friend of Bonnie Fox's. Good, Joe. Thank you. And he was just baptized during the recess in between the services. And I wanted him to stand up so you could see him. This is what's happening, and it's happening all hours of the day and night. Now watch. "Now in these days when the disciples were increasing in number." Now here's a perfect example of what happened here in the first century. In these days when the disciples were increasing in number, something began to happen. An unmet need of a certain segment of the church was causing a murmuring to begin among the people. They weren't being met. Their needs weren't being met. In this particular incident, the Grecian widows were being neglected in the daily distribution of food. Well, how do you get 12 men to serve 15,000 people? It came to the place that the Apostle Peter stood up and said, "Now, brethren, it is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, brethren, pick out from among you 7 men of good repute, full of the Spirit and wisdom, whom we may appoint to this duty. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." You see those three things again? The same three things that were told the people of Israel at the beginning of their walk as a nation, those same three things were told the children of God in the New Testament as the New Testament church began its existence. So at the beginning of two eras, when the disciples began to multiply and the needs began to increase, in the Old Testament they were told, "You leaders give yourselves to prayer, to the teaching of the word, and then appoint some helpers." In the New Testament, the problem was cured in the same way, when he says, "We'll give ourselves to prayer, to the ministry of the word, and we're going to appoint some helpers to help take care of these problems." So actually what we have is we have two examples of God's three-pronged method of taking care of the needs of a congregation or of the body. And I think it's significant. And let's notice it just for a moment, if you will. God's three-pronged or three-step program to facilitate the ministry to the body consists, number one, the number one priority is pray. You might think that that's really out of place. In fact, I think probably we would rearrange it if we were arranging it. We would say, oh, surely that's not the number one priority. That's what Jethro's father told Moses, and that's what Simon Peter told the people of the Jerusalem church. We need to be giving ourselves to prayer. The spiritual leader's first responsibility to his people, I believe, is to pray. Now, Jesus, in his personal ministry, made prayer the central point of his ministry. I've often wondered, for whom did Jesus do all this praying? He'd get up early in the morning and pray a great while before day, Mark 1:35. He would pray all night on another occasion in Luke, the 6th chapter and verse 12. He was praying in John 17. For whom was he praying? He spent a lot of time in prayer. Let me conjecture that I think he was praying for his disciples. I don't believe he was praying for himself. I don't think that Jesus' prayers were self-centered. My prayers usually are self-centered, regarding my work at least. I pray for you in the sense that I pray God help me to meet their needs. And maybe that's the way Jesus was praying. I don't know. But I do know that he was praying for some of his disciples. In Luke, the 22nd chapter, verses 31 and 32, it says that Jesus said to Peter, "Peter, Satan has demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat, but I've prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and when you're converted, you strengthen your brethren." So we know he was praying for Peter. In Luke, the 6th chapter, and verse 12, it says that before he picked out the 12 disciples, he spent all night in prayer, praying for his disciples, praying for wisdom perhaps to pick the right ones, or praying for something as it related to these men that he was going to be spending so much time with. In John the 17th chapter, again, he was praying for disciples, praying for me, you and me, not just the 12, but praying for you and me also. He says, "I'm not just praying for these men, I'm praying for all those who through their word will believe on me." He prayed for me that night. He prayed for you that we might all be one. And there were many other things that he prayed for in the 17th chapter of John that relate to our needs of purity, of love, of unity, of being sanctified in the Word. All of these things were on the heart of Jesus and were one of the last things that he had his mind on before he was attacked in the garden. He was thinking about his disciples. I wonder what would happen if in every congregation throughout this land, all of the elders and all of the evangelists spent their time in this priority. This was the number one on their list. If they would spend their time determining the individual needs of individual members and spend their time praying and petitioning the Father that the needs of these people might be met and that they would have the wisdom to see to it that these needs were met, I wonder what would happen to the church. Brethren, the church of God in America would literally burst the seams if we would get back to the priority that God placed here and says, this is the way I want you to go about it. We would burst the seams. I know what happened over in New Zealand in Christchurch. Every Tuesday, the four evangelists who went there in 1965 would meet on Tuesdays at 9 o'clock. Sometimes we would still be there at 4 o'clock that afternoon. That's 7 hours of discussing the needs of individual members one at a time, and spend many hours on our knees in prayer asking God, please help us, give us the wisdom to know how to meet the needs of these people. We didn't go there through wisdom. I didn't have enough sense to know that this was part of the plan of God. You know why I went there in prayer? The same reason I go to God in prayer all the time. I go there because I am frantic for help. And while we were over there, we were literally frantic trying to take care of about 50 or 60 brand new teenage Christians, if you want to call it. They were just new in the faith. They were babes, and they needed our help, and we didn't know how to go about helping them. So we prayed to God, please, Lord, give us the wisdom to know how to meet these people's needs. I'm convinced that that is the first responsibility of spiritual leadership. And unless the spiritual leaders of every congregation are praying men, they're going to end up as men praying on the people, but they'll not end up as great leaders for God. We need praying men in the eldership. We need men in the eldership who are not ashamed and who are not too busy to spend hour after hour after hour looking into the needs of individual members of the body and then gearing themselves to fill those needs. And yet, all too often, how easy it is for us to let the urgent crowd out the important. In you elders and deacons and the preachers who are here, how often do we let the urgent crowd out the important? How often do we let the temporal and the time-consuming things crowd out the timeless and the eternal? Oh, we let that happen over and over and over. So where you can't get your quiet time in, those of you who are leaders in this congregation here, I know you have to fight for your quiet time. You have to fight for your daily reading of the Word, don't you? I know you do. I do. I have to just fight like somebody in a corner trying to get out to get my quiet time of daily reading and prayer. And I know this, that my effectiveness as a gospel preacher is directly in proportion to the time that I spend in prayer before God. When I stand before you and having prayed fervently to God, please help me, I'll do an effective job. When I stand here on my own strength, I'll bomb out every time because I don't have any strength. I don't have any wisdom. I'm totally dependent upon God and His wisdom. I've known this for 25 years of preaching. It's no new revelation to me. Every leader must be a man of prayer if he's to do the work of the Lord. And yet we find ourselves so many times sidetracked from that first priority. How many times do elders' meetings take upon themselves the form of a business meeting, and the only praying that many times is done is at the beginning of the thing to open it up, and at the end of it to ask God's blessings as we're dismissed. And then in the meantime, the time that is spent from the introductory prayer to the concluding prayer is spent over issues that are 1,000 miles and maybe 10,000 miles away from the individual needs of people living right here who are under the oversight of this congregation or of wherever the congregation may be. You understand what I'm talking about? Many times we find the elders of most congregations serving merely as executors of wills or as distributors of wealth or as the some overseer of tremendous works that span the globe. That's all well and good. But brethren, the members of this congregation desire and deserve and have to have the immediate tutelage and care of members of the body who serve in the capacity of elders. We need that immediate care here in our own lives. We need the care of a pastor or shepherds in our own lives. And many times the churches that exist throughout the land don't get that immediate care. And our elders, many times, they're loaded with works that just simply are not theirs. They don't belong to them. Your primary duty and my primary duty as leaders of God's people, the priority is this: pray for them. In the words of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, he said, "You represent them before God. Pray for them." Peter said, "We're going to give ourselves to prayer." That's the first priority. And I would to God, if I could call upon one thing to be done in every church throughout the land, it would be this: let those who are leading be men of prayer. People who are hungering and thirsting for righteousness do not care for some hail fellow well met to come and minister to them. Those who are yearning at the level of existence where they are, they're longing for a man that's been in close contact with God. And if that close contact cannot be seen in that man's life, and if they cannot sense in that man's association with them that he has a direct and immediate and intimate association with God, you're not going to stimulate any real genuine growth. You may stimulate a lot of hubbub and stir up a lot of dust, but you won't have any lasting results until the leaders become men of prayer. Secondly, preach the word, teach the word. That's the second priority. Spiritual leaders' second responsibility is to teach the word. This was also what Jethro said to Moses. This is what Simon Peter said to the church in Jerusalem. We'll give ourselves to the ministry of the word. Jesus spent much time teaching the multitudes. But in Matthew, the fifth chapter, verses 1 and 2, we get an insight into how he did it, and here's the way he did it. Seeing the crowds, he went up to the mountain, and when he had sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, there are three groups of people here. One group was the multitudes here. A second group were his disciples who came to him after he had gone on up and sat down on a prominent position or a place where they could all see him. He spoke the gospel that he was speaking to the disciples. He allowed the multitudes to overhear him and to more or less get the indirect result of what he was saying to this little select band of men. Let's go further. Look at Matthew, the 13th chapter, where you find Jesus on that particular occasion, verse 1, 2, and 3. That same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea, and great crowds gathered about him so that he got into a boat and sat there, and the whole crowd stood on the beach, and he told them many things in parables, and he told them the parable of the sower. All right? Look at verse 10. Then the disciples came to him and said, privately. It doesn't say privately here, but that's what it is. Why do you speak to them in parables? And he said to them, to you it's been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of God, but to them it has not been given. So here again, you have Jesus conducting a training session with the whole crowd, but he also conducted an extension program, a graduate course, for his own number 12, his men of 12 in number. He conducted a special instruction course with them to where he gave them the benefit of things that the crowds didn't get. In the latter part of this same chapter, verse 24 says another parable he put before them, saying, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. In verse 36, after Jesus had dismissed the crowds, his own 12 disciples came to him in the house and said, would you explain to us the parable of the weeds? And said, yeah, he sat down and told them the parable of the weeds. So he conducted this, what I would call a graduate course in parables, letting the disciples in on what he didn't tell the multitudes. Now this is why. For 3.5 years, Jesus Christ conducted this kind of a training with these 12 men primarily. He poured himself out into these 12 men, spent 3.5 years with them intimately, so that in the time when he would come to be gone, they would then be able to multiply his ministry by 12, and then as they passed this thing on to others, it would multiply just like grains of wheat multiply with the planting of one seed. And in 2 Timothy 2 and chapter 2, Paul recommends this and commands this very method to be used when he said, the things that you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, the same things commit to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Here you have it again. Paul committed these things to Timothy. He said, Timothy, you teach faithful men. They'll be able to teach others. And here it goes. It spreads then like leaven throughout the whole body. This is what is God's method of preparation in teaching. The church in the Hebrew letter was weak because he said, when by reason of time you ought to be teachers, you have need that somebody else teach you the rudiments of the first principles of the oracles of God. Brethren, the church in America is rotting on the vine from the simple failure of spiritual leaders to be intimately involved in the training of core groups, if you please, or to be involved in the training of other people who will be able then to extend this ministry of the elders to the whole congregation, or this ministry of the preacher and the evangelist to the whole congregation. We've not taken the time to get with people and began to pour into them the training and the understanding and the insights and the knowledge and the wisdom the leaders of the church have, and as a result, we've got a very few leaders and a whole host of followers who are not doing anything but sitting on the vine and wondering why it is they're not producing fruit. And unless we can turn this thing around and get the entire body ministering to itself, each one using whatever talent is yours, then the church never will reach its potential. We've just got to do it. Terry's got a clear concept of it, I think. Others have a clear concept of it. We must develop this ministry among ourselves to where every member of the church becomes a functioning member. And I know that you're ready for it, you're prepared for it, you're anxiously awaiting it. And I hope and pray that God will give us the wisdom to implement it. This leads us to the third priority, and that is appoint helpers. Now, you might think that that's just what I got through saying. No, what I just got through saying was the training of these people through an intensive Bible study program, which we're going to be doing for the next 4 months in 2 Corinthians, well, maybe not that long, but we're going to be in this for the next few weeks, at least, in 2 Corinthians to try to train you for this work of ministry that I believe God has laid upon you as a Christian. The third priority, then, after the leaders giving themselves to prayer, after the leaders giving themselves to the ministry and the word, then this third priority is this, appoint helpers. Appoint helpers. And then, by the way, turn it over to them and let them have it. I can't imagine Simon Peter saying, appoint you 7 men now to wait on these tables And then him to stand there with a checklist to make sure that all the food was given, you know, and that a proper listing was given and a proper reckoning was given and that so-and-so's mouth was full and that this bill was paid. Can you imagine him doing that? No. Turn them loose. If they're not qualified, they never should have been appointed in the first place. Are the elders or are the leaders of most congregations willing to do this? No. If the elders and evangelists and, of most congregations would be willing to turn loose those people who could be delegated authority in the sense of responsibility, it would take one half to two thirds to maybe three fourths of the responsibilities that are on our elders. It would take those responsibilities off them and place it on the shoulders of guess who? The deacons, poor ignorant souls. Yeah, not heads, every one of them. Have no respect, no confidence in them, no nothing. Don't you give me anything to do. Let's watch them. Yeah. Most elderships wouldn't give the deacons the time of day. Oh, they let them cut the grass. And they'll let them paint the building, but you don't think they're going to let them pick out the paint, do you? No, sir. What would happen if the work that the deacons are supposed to be doing were taken off the shoulders of the elders? I'll tell you what would happen. It would give the elders the time to devote themselves to prayer and minister the word. That's what would happen. And if the work that has been placed upon the shoulders of the hired evangelists, if that work were taken off of the shoulders of the evangelists and placed upon the shoulders of the members and the deacons, it would free the evangelist also to give himself to prayer and the minister of the word. But we're getting diluted, watered down sermons from the pulpits because of the fact that the men that they've hired to fill the pulpits are having to bear the burden of several other works that don't even belong to those men. And in the meantime, the members sit at home and die from inactivity. The members or the ministers and evangelists of the word are dying of frustration because their jobs are so multiplied and are so varied that they can't hope to cope with all of it. And the elders are overburdened by doing the deacon's work. And you know what happens to the work of taking care of the needs of the people? So many times it goes by the board. One thing I thank God for these elders here, among other things, is they've told me, we want you to spend your time studying and counseling and preaching. And they've given me that charge every year that I've been here. They've emphasized it over and over again. And they've made me take what this says and put it into practice, and I thank God for that. And I would just simply say we need to do that in other ways also. And here's what would happen. If we'll do this, to where everybody then is put into a socket and is plugged in to where he is in touch then with the work of the church and is doing a job, then every one of us will find our talent. We'll then begin to function in the way that we're talented to function. We're going to then, each one, according to his ability, either be an elder or a deacon or a teacher or an evangelist or a song leader or a cook or a table server or a core group leader or a core group member or a dorm minister or a campaigner or a host family or foster parents or the bringers of soap, the bringers of bleach, of tissue paper and whisk, etc. That's what's going to happen. And then we'll all be plugged in and we'll be doing the work of ministering to the body. And I hope and pray that we see that day coming. And I believe that we are, until the time comes, for just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body being many are one body, so it is with Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body. Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, all baptized into one body, Bob. And all were made to drink of one Spirit. For the body doesn't consist of one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I don't belong to the body, that wouldn't make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I don't belong to the body, that wouldn't make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the organs of the body, each one of them, as he chose. If all were a single organ, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye can't say to the hand, because I don't need you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, the parts of the body which seem to be weaker are indispensable. And those parts of the body which we think less honorable, we invest with greater honor. And our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so adjusted the body, giving the greater honor to the inferior part, that there may be no discord in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, everybody suffers with it. All suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. That's what we're after. And brethren, by that one great, when that happens, and this body of people in this location begins to function in this capacity, and you learn what it is to minister to yourselves in a genuine way, and you're learning, and much more is going on than you'll ever see visibly, and it's been going on for years. But there are many who are new, who are desiring to be put into the body function, and it's our responsibility to see that you're put there. And then what's going to happen? Did you ever see a steam engine sitting on the side track? When steam engine, you don't know what a steam engine is, half of you don't. We used to have steam engines, old, that were fired, you know, and stoked with coal. Those old belching billies, you know, and they'd belch black smoke. But they'd just be sitting there going, shh, the steam coming out. And all of a sudden, somebody did something, and that whole thing goes, just shakes from top to bottom, and all of a sudden it starts going just a little bit at a time. And here we go. That's what I hope and pray will happen once we get into the study of the 2 Corinthian letter on the new ministry that's been given to every member of the body of Christ. Man, when that happens, the glory of God will be brought to him in such abundance that I know he's going to be pleased with us. May God grant us that grace to do this. So in these days, when this church is multiplying, each person can be a functioning part and a ministering member of the body and to the body. And thus we'll have the reason also for this coming series from 2 Corinthians. And I urge you to be a part of that body and get plugged into the body of Christ. There may be those who are not plugged in. There may be those who've never become a Christian. You've just become a Christian today, and it's our desire that you be plugged into the body and learn how to function as a member of the body. This young man confessed his faith in Jesus and was baptized into Christ just a few moments ago. Brand new Christian. There are those here tonight who need to do the same thing. If your faith is sufficient to make you stand up and say, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God and I want to serve him the rest of my life, we'll take you and baptize you into him tonight. But if you're just simply one of those that have not really gotten involved and you'd like to use tonight as the first day in the rest of your life to say, I want to go ahead and be involved. Involve me, and I'm going to work. If you want to do that, or if you want to place membership with this congregation, whatever may be your needs or your desires, would you come tonight and start, and let us start serving you as we serve together. Let us stand.
Is your life a channel of blessing? Is the love of God flowing through you?